for me. Does everybody know that story?
Yeah.
No.
And I'll tell you the story.
Good.
We're not going to read the whole thing because it's a whole page. I'll tell you the story. Yes. Here, maybe I'll send some this way.
Good idea.
And the other side is kind of sources, in case you're interested. And I'm sorry, there's sexist language, but I should say that I stole this from various websites, so it's not my sexist language. I don't know what's worse, sexist language or stealing from websites. But so, and I'll just say, let's see, first of all, it's really, it's very exciting to be there. There are some machzorim here if people need them. And we're on page 142, beginning on page 142. And I think it's a really great idea. It's very exciting. As somebody who has no idea what I'm doing when I'm sitting in shul, has no idea why we're saying all these things, I thought this would be a good way to get it, to find, to learn something.
Handouts.
To force myself to learn something. Maybe I'm not alone. I think that there's been a kind of disconnect, that this is a symptom of, a kind of disconnect from what tefillah is, a way in which our culture doesn't lend itself to standing around in shul for many, many hours saying lots of things that are very repetitive. And I was thinking about repetition. I mean, we live in a culture where there's a real taboo against repetition. You know, you're like, when you find yourself repeating a story that you've told someone before, it's always embarrassing. And you know, this is obviously the machzor, the siddur, comes from a culture, or you know, series of cultures that understood the power of repetition and that recognized the value of it in ways that I think we're tone deaf to a little bit. And I was thinking about how this is a prayer where I can really get into the repetition. I mean, for me, the most powerful part of the prayer is, you know, mi yichyeh, mi yamut, mi, 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 mi. And I have no problem with all those me's. I mean, it could go on even longer. And if you know, that actual poetic technique is called litany, where you, rather than a rhyme at the end, you begin a sentence with who will die, who by fire, who by water, who... I can't remember if I'm quoting Unasana Tokef or Leonard Cohen, so you'll excuse me. I think both, right? So so I think that's a moment in which we can... maybe we'll talk about what the prayer is about and how it, I think it manages to retain its power even for us somehow. And why, or maybe I'm just speaking for myself. I chose this prayer because it was the only one I could think of on the spot. And the reason why I could think of it was because it just made a huge impression on me when I was, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 and watching my mother cry. It's very intense to be that age and to watch your parents cry, right? I'm looking around, I see people have had similar experiences. And I just remember that feeling of... there's something, like, for all the, you know, ways in which prayer can be boring and alienating and, you know, tiring, that moment always was very real. People really feel something, I think. I think they still do. And then when I, you know, and I actually just got a hold of this machzor last night, and I was somewhat shocked to see that it's framed in a very blasé way or something. Yeah. It's not marked as like, this is the great in the sonnet.
Yeah.
And I hope it's okay if I use my Ashkenazic, this is the way I daven, so this is what I remember. It's not this, the legend that in the art scroll, in a lot of the machzorim, there's a legend that's told about this prayer, which is dropped in this machzor, and instead we have this kind of subversive, very modern poem by someone I actually know, by Admiel Kosman, which is a completely different framing of the prayer. And when I asked Sholem Bachner last night, he finished his little thing here by saying, I have so many things to say about Unatana Tokev, but I don't have time. I went over and I said, what do you want to say? You know, I have to talk about it tonight. So he said, well, I wanted to tell people about the story about Amnon of Mainz and how disappointed I was that it's not in. It's the one disappointment I feel about this Machzor. Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about what it means to frame this prayer in different ways, the way it's framed here and the way it's framed in the old Machzor. And I'll tell you what these framings are. And I couldn't figure out, do I first talk about the prayer and then talk about the framing, or talk about the framing and then, I don't know how to do it. So of course I'm going to do it in a slightly confusing way. I'll just say that the prayer, Unasana Tokef, has four sections, as far as I could tell. The first one is a kind of sets the stage for Unatana Tokef, I think itself, Kedushat Hayom, is itself a very unusual way to start a prayer. I think it's translated here as let us speak of, it's not let us speak, let us place, let us put, let us make, let us give, let us set the stage of, I'm on page 143. So it starts by setting the stage for what's really supposed to be happening today, you know, but isn't really laid out anywhere else. I mean, this is what you get when you ask me. One of the problems of the Machzor is, like, where exactly does it say what's going on, you know? And this is where it tells you what's going on. Apparently, allegedly, theoretically, theologically, God is sitting above and judging us all. And this is where it sets the scene. This is the prayer where it really lays that out in very visual form. And one of the reasons I brought the source is because it's very interesting to see, first of all, how somebody manages to create a narrative from a little piece of Job and a little piece of Psalms and a little piece of all these different places, something in the Talmud and something in the Mishnah, and to create what looks like, you know, a cinematic scene of God judging us from little hints in various sources. And it's also interesting to see what's not in any of those sources. So I'll be pointing those out maybe when I think we should really read the prayer. But first I want to set the frame. But first I want to tell you what the frame is. And then it says that this is Rosh Hashanah. This is when this is when our fate is written. And then there's the famous Miba Mayim, and this is, I think, where in some of the women's machzorim it says, this is where you cry. But I don't think people need instructions. It's terrifying. I mean, it's really a very terrifying thing, and it's about you. You know, there's no doubt that we're sitting there thinking, and one of the things that's interesting about this prayer is it doesn't say the word Jew anywhere. It's not about you, the Jew. It's about you, the mortal. The earthling, we can say, you, the particular earthling, you and you alone. And then it's all of a sudden the mood lifts, but you got something you can do. There's legal services. No, not really. There's, by the way, speaking about legal services, it's actually kind of scary from a democratic point of view because it says, God, who dayan umochiach v'yodea va'et, he's everything. He's judge, he's jury, he's the court reporter, but then the very end it says, v'chotem yad kol adumbo, but it's your signature that's on this document. That's not in any of the sources. As far as I could tell, maybe someone will tell me I'm wrong. So, and then it says to the famous teshuvah, tefillah, tzedakah, mavirim, et ro'ah ha'gzerah, which maybe we'll look at that and try to figure out what that means, how much hope we have.
Pre-bargaining.
What does that mean? The, you know, repentance, prayer, and charity will something. It's not entirely clear. And then it says, and God is great, and this is the part of we're like dust, and God, there's no, everything that we're terrified of, God doesn't have to worry about. No death for God. And then it goes into the Kedusha, and this is something that's read in the repetition, this is what we need, right? The repetition of the Amidah of Rosh Hashanah, the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That's and it's right before the Kedusha. And I heard, and I've been trying to listen to YouTube. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube. Someone said on YouTube, I can't remember who, that Kedusha is always a call and response. Uh-huh. That all the
Rabbi
Kedusha...
Kelman.
Oh, he said that.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So Kedusha is really in some way an intersubjective construction. Does anyone have a tissue? I'm not crying, yes. But I still need a tissue. Thank you. I'm about to. So, okay, here is the...
When you're told.
When I'm told to cry.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, I'm wondering if we'll still cry with, oh, thank you. Man. It's like the moms who, you know, come with their big bags prepared with everything. You probably have a snack in there, too, right? Then, okay, well.
A safety pin you should never think about.
Maybe you need the Band-Aid when you stick yourself in the safety pin.
Okay, so why did I choose it? Oh, so the frame. Here's the frame, the traditional frame that's in the Art Scroll Mahzar, which none of you will be using, and I don't necessarily recommend it. But so it's the story of Rabbi Amnon of Mainz, who lived in maybe the 12th century, and this is recorded as fact in many of the Machzorim. And I'll just say right now that if it was included in this one, given the conservative movement and the academic level here, it would have had to say the legendary origins of this prayer. But I think that's okay. I mean, I don't have any problem with legendary origins. I don't believe that... I mean, I think it's meaningful, but it's meaningful in a certain way that maybe no longer is important to us. Rabbi Amnon of Mainz, who scholars say not only didn't exist, but couldn't have existed, there's no Amnons in the 12th... Whatever, we know that it couldn't have been written later, this prayer couldn't have been written later than the 10th century. It's exactly in exactly the same place in all the Ashkenazic rites, which diverged starting in the 10th century. There's Cairo Geniza evidence. It's alluded to in an Italian Jewish source of the 10th century. So there's no doubt that this is no later than the 10th century. But as the story goes, there's someone named Rabbi Amnon of Mainz who was, and you can follow along quickly on this page, and the story is recorded in a commentary on the Talmud on the part on Rosh Hashanah.
Do you have any
more? Yes, I do. Oh, wait, I only have a few more.
Simply, we have more.
So,
I'll pass mine up.
No, we have Lydia. We have one.
So, and I'm just curious, like, what percentage of the people sitting in this room knew the story?
I did.
I didn't know all about the story, though, about the 10th century.
Yeah. So, Rabbi Amnon of Mainz was a distinguished Jewish rabbi, a scholar, handsome, rich. And he was friends with the bishop. In English, it translates bishop in some places. Other places in the Hebrew, it's sarim, the I don't know, the princes, the ministers, important Christians of the town, who were friends with him and always say, "Why don't you convert? Why don't you convert to Catholicism?" And he would always say, "Thanks, but no thanks," or try to just get out of it. And at one point, they were bothering him so much, he just said, "Let me think about it for 3 days," in the hopes, apparently, of getting 3 days of peace from them. And he went home and immediately felt so guilty that he had led them to believe that he would even consider the possibility of converting to Christianity, that he couldn't be consoled, and I think sent word, am I remembering this correctly, for those of you following along, he sent word to the bishop that he deserved the punishment of having his tongue cut out for having said that. What?
That's after the bishop got him dragged there. He just didn't answer at all.
And then the bishop said, "No, we won't cut out your tongue because you spoke well. But what we'll do is we'll cut off your feet because you didn't come to me, and your hands for not." So he and at every they did all this in a very dramatic fashion, a finger at a time. And each time they said, "Will you convert? Will you convert?" And he said, "No, no, no." And this happened right before Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, he was brought to the synagogue with his limbs on a tray, and he apparently composed this prayer. And
except for the fact he would have been dead already.
As he was dying. And then since no one nobody was writing on Rosh Hashanah except for God, I guess.
He disappeared right then and there. He disappeared, his whole body disappeared.
In all his parts. Disappeared in all his parts.
Disappeared with all his parts. With all his parts.
This is on this paper?
Maybe I should have read this a little more carefully. and then he came in a dream 3 days later. He came to, in other words, after the Chag, he came to Rabbi, what's his name? Meshulam of Clonimus, Ben Rabbi Meshulam, and taught him Unatana, Unasana Tokef.
Wait, in a dream.
And this was instituted as part of the liturgy. And this legend, which became part of the way this prayer was understood around this period, presumably. So the associations of this prayer with this particular story are very, very old. And they're certainly remembered, and part of what people are crying about, I think, when they read this prayer, is, I think, the memory of this story.
Yeah.
And to me, it just seems very. I'm struck by the fact that our new machzor, in a remarkable exercise of poetic license, this is what it says to introduce this. The anonymous author of this treasured high holy day prayer has transformed the prophetic image of the end of days to today. Which is a very interesting comment on the end of day, that this imagery transforms messianic, the poem transforms messianic imagery to, we're experiencing this today. We're experiencing a kind of, but in other words, that whole story, that whole legend is basically, anonymous author is all you get. We're, enlightened modern Jews who now know that we don't know who wrote this. And we will not even mention it as a legend, and instead we'll talk about something, I think, something very different about the prayer. So I was just wondering whether we could read this, maybe read the Unatana Tokef through once, if we have time, and then just say, what does it mean to frame and read that prayer through the lens of this legendary story, and what does it mean to abandon that frame? And does it change meanings? This is, and it's not like I have thought this out. I didn't have time. I told you I realized it didn't have the frame yesterday, and I had a busy day today. So anything you come up with I'll be coming up with right now. But I think that hopefully that's an interesting and open. In other words, this isn't, like I have an answer and try to guess it. This is, help me think about this. So, should we read it in Hebrew or in English? Or so maybe let me just say a couple of things about the.
Yeah, I agree. A little bit of both.
A little bit of both. So, why don't I say something? Who wants it? Someone read it in Hebrew, and then we'll read it in English, and then maybe I'll make a few comments about. It's always important to sort of say what's lost in translation in terms of the stylistic form, and so I'll try to do that pretty quickly. So can somebody read it in Hebrew?
How much of it?
Just on the first the first paragraph.
Unatana toke kedushat hayom kihu norav hayom uvo tinaseh malchutecha vayikon bechesed kisecha v'teshev halav be'emet ki atahu dayan u'mochiach Veodea, the aid. Vikotev, Vikotem, the sofer. Umone, the tizkor, kol, hanish kachot. Batif taf, et, sefer, hazichronot. Ume elav, yikare, vechotem, yad, kol, adam, bo.
In English?
Kind of weird to just hear it read in Hebrew, by the way, without hearing the music.
Yeah. Can someone sing it?
That, you know,
does anyone know the
it's
music?
It's such a somber, so somber musically.
I can sing the first couple lines.
Who could sing
I can sing the first couple lines.
Yeah, do you mind?
Not at all.
Unetanetokef kedushot hayom ki hu nora v'ayom ותשב עליו באמת. Oh my God, I just got shivers.
Yeah. Well, I think this it's not really truly a prayer. I mean, if you look at the language in the Hebrew, but it's like Kol Nidre. I mean, if it's chanted, it's so prayerful. I can't believe what they've done to this. You pointed this out to me, and I feel like sobbing.
Well, you're supposed to.
No, but I mean, I'm for what's missing from the framing of it.
I mean, one of the obvious things that's missing is it rhymes. It's a piyut. It's a poem, and it rhymes and really.
The line breaks.
The ayom.
The line breaks are gone. What does that mean to just get rid of the line breaks? I mean, this is, in some ways I said this was cinematic. It's poetic and cinematic. In other words, and also the unatana, let us speak of unatana, let us, unatana tokef means in Hebrew, I haven't seen this as a translation and I haven't done research, but in modern Hebrew it means let us make valid, Zebetokef means it's valid for now. It's betokef, zebetokef matriel me. In other words, this rule is valid from. Mm-hmm. So it's like we are, there's a kind of, it's both incredibly, you know, powerful in terms of the imagery of God, but it also gives a certain kind of agency to us. Mm-hmm. We create a certain kind of, we're setting the stage.
Yeah.
But in terms of what the rhyme does, I mean, rhyme is an example of meaning that isn't about the content. It's meaning that, you know, how does rhyme work? I'm looking at what rhymes with what is always very interesting. You remember kol hanishkachot v'tiftach et sefer hazichronot. So you remember the forgotten rhymes with, and you open the memory. There's a kind of poetic logic. You know, it's something about the way the Bible works, what's called the chiastic structure. Or you can think about it in terms of a sort of poetic version of karma. Things reflect each other. It's almost like things. Also,
can
what's
you explain this idea of chiastic?
Well, chiastic structure is you do evil, God reacts in this way, God does this, you react in that way. In other words, things are cause and effect, and that they somehow they're repeated and they cross each other in interesting ways.
It's also visual, though. It's a literal visual. A chiastic is also, it's a visual. Which is completely gone here.
The visual is gone, and the chiasm is a kind of poetic structure that's also theological. It tells you the reason why our lives invite poetic structure is because things have consequences. And because we do something in the world and something comes back. And biblical poetry is all about that. It's all about this kind of, it's a kind of poetry of what?
Sometimes a call and response also.
Right, yeah, right.
In our generation, the line, don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. That's a chiastic.
Right.
But I think that Rabbi Kalman said last night that there's a kind of questioning of the whole idea of cause and effect, the whole kind of karmic aspect of Judaism, that they're struggling with that.
In this mosque. Well, what does it mean to say God? You know what? I think that might end up being what that story of Rabbi Amnon tells us about this.
Very deep. It's spiritual shares.
But I'll give you one example of a place where chiasm is imperfect, and when it's when there's a lurch or a stutter in the system, is where it tells you. It's not all beautiful. It's not all everything we do gets an equal response. And I think that maybe, here I am maybe getting ahead of ourselves, but maybe the story of Rabbi Amnon is that there aren't equal responses, that there are overwhelmingly unequal, I mean, more like Job than biblical. Job is, we don't know why things happen. But I'm thinking about the word chotem, which means yichatemu, right, to be sealed, or to be signed. It's an interesting double.
It's all legal. It's
all legalese. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're all mirroring legal acts. Of, you just see like the sealing wax coming down, you know, almost.
Right. Mm-hmm. But what's so interesting is that the whole Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we say over and over again, you know, Gemar Chasima Tova, have a good seal, you know, get the final stamp, and I hope it's in your favor. You know, you need, it's like running around to the registrar when you're a graduate student trying to get all the right signatures. Right? get the right signatures.
Classes that you need.
Right. But one of the things about this is that this is the one place that I know of. I mean, this is what I said. Yeah, it's all repetition. It's all the same. You know, we're standing there in shul for hours and hours and hours, repeating ourselves. Oh, I have an idea. Why don't we just repeat the Lamida over again? You know, why don't we do that again? And then all of a sudden we have something that's not a repetition, which is this strange V'chotem Yad Kol Adam Bo, which if you look at just the previous sentence, it says V'chotem V'chotem, God writes, God signs, and then all of a sudden every document that comes out of God's, I don't know, legal files, you signed
every
yourself.
Yeah.
It's really astonishing. I mean, how is it translated here? And which speaks, may I love you, Yikare V'chotem Yad Kol Adambo. It's like, how did that happen? Yeah.
It's been rhetorical. It was forcing us into the intensity. It says, let us give intensity, power to this day, because it is a terrible day. The word key is repeated. It's sort of,
right.
Don't start falling asleep here.
Right.
We're really approaching the, it's kind of building up of the atmosphere.
And then yom and ayom. Mm-hmm. And yom is day, ayom is, ayom even in modern Hebrew, terrible, awesome, horrendous, ayom v'nora, nora v'ayom, it's like that somehow you've produced that word out of the day in some, there's a place in which what in modern prosody would be considered a kind of weak rhyme, because it's almost a repetition of the same sounds, is actually more powerful because it's quote unquote a bad rhyme. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think there's kind of a double meaning to chotem here. Mm. You know, or I mean, it's using, it's the same word, but you know, you're talking about God. When you first read God will chotem, it means God is going to seal book, close it, end it, right?
Right.
But then it comes back and says, but if you look, you'll see that each person, you know, and this is like a signet ring, like a stamp, I think,
right,
is what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that if you look, that people have already stamped it. So even though God is closing it, each person is responsible. You know, your mark is on it. So it's kind of a double way of thinking right. about it, that God's closed it finally, but your mark was there before.
I like that, though. Maybe I could just say, I like that double way. I think that this is another way of saying is that God's way of reading you, there's no daylight between who you are and God's way of reading you. They're more or less the same thing. What were you going to say?
Actually, a little bit of the opposite. Well, first of all, this feels very Reb Nachman-like, you know, the trembling of...
Reb Nachman?
Yeah.
I'm wearing my Reb Nachman amulet. Right. The dead Rebbe. The mortal, the Rebbe who was the great spokesperson for mortality and finitude.
And he trembled, yeah. But this morning I was reading Nechama Leibovich, and the section about, I think, the idea of God, divine intervention and taking responsibility for yourself is very consistent in Torah. Mm. And it was the section about Yaakov when he's going to meet Esau, and how he sets things up. He divides his camp. He sends gifts, and then he did a little out of order, but then he prays for divine intervention. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how that's really what is expected of Jews, you know, is that you do everything you can within your power to change the outcome, and then you ask for divine intervention, but you don't start with asking. Mm. In other words, you don't start with asking for forgiveness. You would start with what you're going to do to earn it.
Mm.
And so, you know, the Utana Tokef is so much a prayer for that I remember from childhood, and it was so scary because of this guy without his arms and feet, you know, that wrote it. But there, that in itself made it solemn. As I got older, I never believed the story, but the circumstances gives it a solemnity.
I was shocked to hear it was a legend. It was news to me. I found out on Wikipedia, I think.
There's a bridge you might like to buy.
There's an impeachable source.
Right. Just better add a chapter.
I just want to say that if this prayer has been said since the 10th century, there's no question how many Jews were tortured and murdered. He said this prayer. And when we say this prayer, you can go back. If this is not fact, it's fact.
Yeah, I feel
it doesn't have to be the circumstances. Mm-hmm. It can be the general circumstances.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something on sort of the other side of that coin of the value of remembering kind of groups of martyrdom and keeping that image in our mind. It's certainly, you know, very powerful, and but you know, I also have to say, having gone to Jewish day school, part of my experience with Judaism that I didn't like growing up was the message that, you know, you better be a good Jew because a lot of people have bled and suffered and died from this religion. And I'm like, is that really how we want to call people to involvement in our community, in our tradition? And, you know, we have Ayla Esker, oh, right? So if they didn't take that out,
we can still remember anti-Semitism, but we can face our mortality outside of that framework.
Right.
And maybe we don't have to blame some horrific bishop who never existed for death.
Of a rabbi who never existed.
Is that what you're saying? Maybe it's time to let that go.
Can I just toss it?
Yeah. Wait, I see. Let me call on the bunch of people who have their hands up now. Bette and Paul and Robin. And did I see Arabella? No, you're just fixing your hair. And Edna.
Okay.
Do I know everyone here, or do I know everyone here?
Yeah, you're doing something. You remember, too.
You're good. So maybe I've read too much Buddhism. I apologize. But there is that sort of legend about, you know, this pinch and we forget everything. And this idea of the seal of remembrance, what it says to me is a kind of more hopeful thing, that we made this pact before we came in, and that these are the lessons we're going to learn. And even if it means I'm going to lose all my fingers, I'm going to get cancer, all the most terrible things that are going to happen to me, this is part of the pact I made. What's the big deal? I'm going to have bad things happen to me. I'm going to die. But I'm a Jew. I'm here, and to put some meaning into that. So that's kind of what I get out of it.
I don't hear it as, okay, I'm going to die and maybe people will cut my limbs off first. I hear it as, oh my God, I'm going to die!
Yeah, well, we have that too.
I'm sorry. And, you know, yeah. I'm somebody who, I mean, Buddhism is great.
I got this experience crawling under the temple of Apollo in Delphi because the guy who came in said that that's what they did when they got the oracle, okay?
Right.
They crawled under. So I thought, well, you know, I'm an experiencer, an explorer. And when I told the guy who was leading the trip that I actually did it, he went crazy. He said, didn't they try to drag you out? No. I went through the passages and it was almost dark, and then it became very dark. And I saw my death coming to me. And it was really, really scary. Mm-hmm. I agree. It's, But it's just what happens. We're here we're here to learn. And maybe some of it's going to be very, very scary, but if we can remember that we're here to help others and to learn, that's why we're here.
Yes, absolutely. I have to take a little issue with you, which is that, you know, Yom Kippur, it's about doing right, it's about tshuva, and this prayer also is about doing right, and there's a moral to be learned from it, and maybe, and it doesn't say, you know, if you do right, God isn't going to kill you, because we know that that's not an option. It'll go a little better with you, I think is the best that you could translate. I would just say that there's a moment here, and that's what I saw in my mother's face, and I think that's what we face. Before the takeaway, before the tshuva, before the be a good person, that's a confrontation with mortality that there is no lesson in. It just is, this is what you face. Right now, this is what you have to face.
Totally.
And it doesn't say who will perish by fire is the person who, you know, deserves to perish by fire.
Totally.
It just says some of you will get horrible forms of cancer, and we're not saying you deserve it.
That's right.
At least not right here. And to me, Rabbi Amnon did not deserve it.
Totally.
And, no matter and I would just say that, can I just say one more thing? I know you want to speak. Which is that on the little PC prayer translation, I'm sorry to put it down in this way. Where is it? It says something about, okay, on page 143, who shall be truly alive and who shall merely exist? Who shall be happy and who shall be miserable? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We're not talking about who shall merely exist.
No.
We're talking about who will have a particularly horrible, undeserved bout of chemotherapy. And this is a place that faces it in a way that this marginal modern poem doesn't. I'm sorry to be getting so outraged at this.
I agree with you.
Robin and Paul.
This thing up here.
I've never heard the legend until tonight. Grew up with this prayer, but maybe it was written in the margins and the small print, and as a dyslexic, I chose not to look at it. I don't know. But I, not knowing that legend, this is just as much power for me and always had, and made my family cry and made me cry as a child and still does. So I don't think we need that legend in order to feel this power of confronting our mortality, which is what this is about. And I certainly, I think that in defense of the Machzor, not that I had any part in it, but I think that what Rabbi Kimmel was saying last night was they wrote this book to address different populations. They thought about who was going to have it in their hands and what it is, the different ways that people could be accessing this stuff. And I think it may have been at least, and I don't know this for a fact, but it may have been at least partially an attempt to get away from what Joel was talking about.
It's all because of the Christians.
Every generation needs to write its own Machzor, because in each generation there's a different way that we are Jews. And I think in this generation, in American Judaism, conservative Judaism, we are not all about the Christians persecuting us. That's not what we're about. And so I think that they removed that perhaps, so that we were dealing with the mortality issue, which is universal, mm-hmm. and that and not that. So for me, it doesn't lose a thing because maybe because I never had it to begin with. I mean, never this legend.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that I'm not someone who believes that a meaning of something like a prayer is about when it was written. Mm-hmm. I think meanings accrue, mm-hmm. and we're talking about an accrued meaning that at some point is stripped away in the name of, I don't know, either in the name of a machzor for our time or a kind of academic pursuit of accuracy. Accuracy. Yeah, it was Paul and then you. I'm sorry, and I don't know your name.
Martha.
What a beautiful voice you have. And you'll get to use it.
One thing is the historical context of the story of Rabbi Amnon. And you look at the date, and it is exactly at the time of the First Crusade.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And this was a time, you know, whether you like it or not, where horrific things were done to Jews. And it does always give the sense that this is beyond, above and beyond what anybody needs to go through in their life in order to suffer. And then here...
But what does it mean to connect it with this particular prayer?
Because
it's not self-evident.
The prayer is one of infinite tension. There's this infinite tension in the litany between this and that, and you're left hanging because you don't know where you're going to wind up. You know, it could be A or it could be B, and you don't know. And you look back on the year that's passed, and you think, well, this happened to this person, and this happened to this person that I know, and this happened to this person I know, and you start, and that's when you really start trembling, because it affects you, just like it affected Rav Amnon.
Right. Becomes, we're probably pretty safe from wild beasts, I think.
Well,
most
know,
of us.
Aaron's hiking and wild catching this afternoon. I don't know.
What do you call the marauding, the marauding gangs of Oakland?
First of all, I have to say that I can't laugh about this prayer. Mm-hmm. I think the Amnon story, whether it's true or not, circumcises the heart. And it's a preparation for this. It's like a tractate. I can't even call it a prayer. And to me, hearing it as the cantor chanted it, I felt that not that he knew which of the people in the congregation was going to die by fire or by, but that he had a sense and was able to keep his voice and able to still chant, knowing that someone was going to die, that some number of people that he shook hands with and that he loved were going to die. And when I grew up and realized that I could become a chazan, I didn't know as a girl. I mean, I left Judaism for a number of years until I knew that I looked out in this 3,000 people in the Reform congregation, and I saw the old ones, and I saw the people that chances were good that I wouldn't see them next year, and I could live with that. It didn't speak to me as an individual. It spoke to me as a group.
Mm.
Interesting.
That as a people, some of us were going to not be here, mm-hmm. and I could accept that, and I could live with that, mm-hmm. and yet we were going to exist. To me, it was about existence and about being. Some of us were going to be here next year, and someone else was going to be able to chant this if I couldn't. And now my chazan is gone, Alav Shalom, and I'll be gone, but somebody else will be able to chant this. And it's about the continuation, to me. What does it say about prayer? And I mean, all this stuff, it isn't about each individual so much to me as it's about the continuation.
It's interesting because it's also, you know, making each... Mavir tzono tachas shifto. Where's what am I quoting here? Kain tavir v'dispar. It really is the feeling of each one, and you. I mean, there's a feeling of extreme. I mean, Rosenzweig talks about Yom Kippur as a feeling of extreme solitude. Like, this is not, everything in Judaism is about the congregation, everything's communitarian, but this is Kol Ba'e Olam, each one of you. So I see some more people want to talk. Jonathan, and then Shoshana, and...
I don't see this as a central theological statement of Yom Kippur. I see this instrumental part of a whole series of pieces. El Eskara, the Yiskor, why do we have Yiskor and Yom Kippur? They're all there to break your heart. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing building up of a breaking of the heart that means that leads to being able to reach Ne'ilah, clean.
Yeah.
And Yom Kippur ends with Adonai Hu Elohim. And everything leads up to that until you've broken your heart.
It's a dissipation.
I don't think you can get there. So I don't see this as having any... I love this prayer, and we for
too.
Different reasons each year. Just, I don't think it's a major theological idea. It's just part of the atmosphere that builds up.
I agree that it's that turning it into theology is moving too quickly toward what you could call a takeaway, a lesson. This equals this. This is a place of... The reason for the repetition is because there are 5 billion people on the planet, and we're picturing that, and we're going... We don't want to get to that. We don't want to get to the conclusion too quickly. So, yes.
I just want to go back to what I was saying for 1 second. There is a direct connection between the tale and the piece.
Is there?
Because what does the Archbishop do? He cuts off his fingers so that he cannot sign, because he knows he needs to sign at the end of the day. And this is where he says, and the seal of every man's hand is on it, and you shall remember the soul of every living thing. And that's why the Archbishop cuts off his fingers. Because it's
an
instrument in which he needs to be able to physically activate this prayer. It's on the second side.
What you're saying is that this frames the story as opposed to the story framing this.
Interesting. Yeah.
This frames the story.
This prayer, if it's not actually a prayer, but this is a declaration.
Right.
It frames that story.
Right. One of the things that's interesting is one of the things that this prayer doesn't say is, I mean, it says God judges us, but it doesn't say that the judgment is equivalent to the sins.
Right.
It doesn't say that anywhere in this prayer.
One of the things that you had said in the beginning was like, what are we losing by losing the story, or what are we gaining by not having it in? And I think that one of the things that I've noticed in my study of the liturgy itself, and any liturgy, is that it's important to know and recognize when a prayer was actually written, to recognize why they wrote it the way they wrote it. So in the context of when this was written, was it written in the 10th century? Was it written in the 11th century? What was going on in the Jews of that time? And why would they write something like this? Why would this speak to them
no,
at that time?
No, it's pre-Crusades. Apparently it's pre-Crusades, and the best guess is it's Northern Italy. Mm-hmm. It's a poem that brings, in other words, it's interesting to think, I mean, I think that both of those things are true, that a poem means what it meant when it was composed, and a poem means what it has been taken to mean.
And
it continues to accrue new meanings that are valid.
Absolutely, but I think in terms of like, it's a poem at this time, we've turned it into a prayer. In our effort, we just need to figure out what we can take out of it now.
Yes.
Based on the reasons that they wrote it.
I would just say, Nan, do you have something that would work as a tie this up with the knot?
Yes, it's a very short thing, and that is that this prayer poem stays with me through the year, the days, the months ahead.
Yeah.
It's such a statement of a primal relationship. And I go back to it again and again because we're talking about the year ahead. It's not only the past, but it's the year ahead. and it informs how I live the year ahead. It just reminds me again and again, because, you know, mortality is so intense, and my own fears and so forth and so on. So I come back and back and back again to this relationship with the divine.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Oh, thank you. That
was wonderful. Goodell, a sticker Goodell inside the front cover.
Do you want to sit here?
I have Janet Harris's. I don't know how that happened.
Thank you so much.
Should we buy?
I mean, what do I say? It's too early to say. What do you say at this point to people who wish you a meaningful... Oh my God, did I say... I forgot to say that I wanted this to be the Eloy Mishmas. My father's yard site is tomorrow.